At this time of year, we hear a lot of familiar Christmas carols, but over the years, Christmas music has taken many forms not so familiar today. And the late 17th and early 18th centuries, the Baroque era, was particularly fertile time for Christmas music. We'll hear some of the pieces that came from that era of music during this hour. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Sharing some of these musical Christmas treasures with us is Trevor Stevenson, founder and director of the Madison Bach Musicians.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
Before we talk about the Christmas music in general and sample more of it, mm-hmm. tell us just a little bit about the Madison Bach Musicians.
Yes. Well, we are over halfway through our ninth season right now, which is just amazing to me that it's gone that quickly. So in 2004, just a few local musicians who had very keen interest in Baroque music and playing it on period instruments, we got together and practiced up and decided to give a concert, and it was very well received. And so, you know, one thing leads to another, and we just said, well, let's go further with this and keep doing more, especially more pieces by our beloved figurehead, Johann Sebastian Bach.
Oh, I thought you meant by your beloved figurehead, Trevor Stevenson.
No, the man, Mr. Bach. And so we do primarily his music, you know, throughout the year, and done several cantatas, you know, each season, we did St. Matthew Passion and B Minor Mass a few years back, and so anyway, it's a wonderful life, as they say.
And you tried to do it in it would have been performed at the time,
right? So you know, by playing it on period instruments, and one of the main things there is, of course, the gut strings on the string instruments and the much more lightweight bows that they use, and the bows are shaped differently. What this encourages is, with the string, the sweetness of the gut string is a kind of a non-vibrato style of playing, because the gut string just sounds good without vibrato. It's a very, very natural type of sound. And then you add the bow to it, which is very strong at the frog, where you hold it, and very weak at the tip. It's the way it's designed on purpose, so that you have a lot of inflection, kind of a binary field between the positive downstroke, you know, and then the weaker part at the end of the bow, which is related to dance rhythms, you know, that it has a lot of, you bend your knees on the downbeat and you come up in the middle of the bar, that type of thing. So when you put that together with this non-vibrato style, you get, you know, kind of the pillars of the Baroque practice, you know. And I mean, of course, it's like talking about, how do you do Shakespeare? I mean, it's complicated, but that's the foundation of it, is that. And of course, throughout the United States and throughout the world, there are now, you know, thousands of musicians really who do this for a living. And it has grown and grown over the past 50 or 60 years, remarkably. And you know, even in the CD bin, flipping through the CD bin, if there is such a thing anymore, at the CD
the
store.
The virtual CD bin.
It is, you know, is laden with Baroque recordings right now.
And a lot of times they'll say original instruments.
Yeah, they'll say the period instruments.
Now, those period instruments or original instruments, as you describe them, softer voiced than contemporary strings? And how do they carry in a larger venue?
Right. Well, you tend to choose your halls wisely as well. They aren't not just literally not as loud. They're much more articulate than their modern counterparts because of the way the bow and the gut string work together. So they speak very quickly, but they don't have as much pump to the sound, you know. You choose your hall wisely and make sure that it is a resonant space in itself, which, you know, many, many concert halls are. There are, of course, as we all know, some that were designed where the padded seats and the kind of soft walls or just the shape of the room is getting in the way and killing the sustain, and that is a very poor choice for a Baroque
hall.
You'll need some good hard pews.
Good hard pews. That's right. Puritan pews. Right. And you know, usually don't play in places that seat more than 1,000. You know, is basically a good idea. And you know, and of course, the way the halls were built in those days, it was wood, plaster, marble, I think, you know, modern musicians appreciate those acoustics as well.
And if we're talking about church music, by hall, we probably mean a church, right? If we're talking about Christmas music.
Often, yes, which is where we just gave our Baroque holiday concerts in the wonderful acoustics over at First Congregational Church. I said, we all know it as First Congo, right? First Congregational Church over on Breeze Terrace by Camp Randall Stadium, which is a kind of a Georgian design, I believe is what you call it, and it just records wonderfully. We'll hear it in this program. Several of the cuts are from that concert.
I know some of the samples that you have feature singers. Is there anything that a vocalist does differently in order to sound period-like?
Yes, right. And of course, vibrato is one of the main things. The idea is that with the singing as well as the string playing is if you don't vibrate so widely, if you keep it narrow or not at all in some places, and the harmonics of the note that you're making are a little more they're distinct, right? It's not a moving target. There is a much greater opportunity for that note to catch the harmonics of the person next to you, of the other part of the chord or whatever, so you can get this beautiful blend, and so the idea is, all for one and one for all. It's to make your sound lock with the person next to you. And of course, then it requires a slightly different approach to intonation as well. You've got to be largely, in many ways, outside yourself. You have to listen to the person next to you as much as you listen to yourself.
And listen to the instruments too, though, right?
Right. And yeah. So the singers mix it up. They're classically trained and they're, singing, with many techniques that are shared with opera and all that. But some of the style that they're doing is in many ways more akin to jazz singers who vibrate as a coloration sometimes toward the end of the note, that type of thing, as opposed to the vibrato really being there all the time as it is in opera, and it's very wide. So
now what are we going to hear from the Chiamelli Notebook by Bach?
Yes, we're going to hear soprano Amy Howeth, who made a recording with Madison Bach musicians this October, she'll be singing two Christmas songs from a set of spiritual songs that Bach wrote for a friend of his, a colleague named Chiamelli, we don't know how it was said. It was like a compendium of family spiritual practice, and these are works that go for Christmas. The first is I Stand by the Cradle. Baby Jesus's cradle in this case, and then the second is a very sweet lullaby to the baby Jesus. Oh, sweet and dear baby Jesus, sent here to do God's work.
And what instrumentation do we hear with Amy Howeth?
This one is starts with harpsichord. I'm playing the harpsichord, and it's on lute stop. It's a very peculiar stop on the harpsichord where these leather pads kind of blunt up against the end of the string and make the harpsichord sound remarkably like a lute. And then the second is the harpsichord with its plain open wire kind of thing. I think there may be that gamba may be joining in on the second verse of the, come to think of it. And that if it does, that's Anna Steinhoff.
The suspense is killing.
On the gamba, on the viola da gamba.
What a pure, beautiful sound that is.
It's just, she says it's a wonderful singer. Amy has been singing with the Talis Scholars for four or five seasons now. And it's just, yeah. And that, I was saying to you guys while we were listening to it, that the church that was recorded in Milwaukee seats around 200 people at the most. And yet it, the vault of it is very high, and it, the reverb is so, it's so elegant, and there's all this interesting information going on for quite a while, and which Amy Howarth, the soprano, works to perfection, I think, in that. So
now there is this tradition of Christmas concertos in the Baroque era, and I'm not aware that Vivaldi wrote one,
right?
But he did, you're telling us, write one that sounds like it. Yeah. It's very suitable for Christmas.
Right. The Italian Jingle Bells. It's just a very festive piece, you know, and it's a very short kind of, it has almost an overture type sound to it.
Yeah, this is like record short even for a Vivaldi concerto.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure there are probably recordings that are even shorter than this, right? People who play it faster.
Well, they do tend a lot to play Vivaldi with, I call it the smoking fiddle effect, because it's so fast that it's almost tasteless sometimes.
I know. So, but so,
but
again,
we'll be hearing the Madison Bach musicians performing this.
This was it was on December 14th, and at First Congregational Church. And Kang Won Kim is the concertmaster and leading a group. This is about 8 strings and harpsichord.
And it's a concerto in D, which consists, mm-hmm. They typically did in Vivaldi's time, of 3 movements. Thank you. Concerto in D by Antonio Vivaldi. So you had, you said, what, 8 or 9 players?
That's, I think, that? 8. That's, you know, 2 firsts, 2 seconds, 2 violas, and 2 cellos, and harpsichord. And that's
– so you get a big sound, almost an orchestral sound.
Right.
That small.
It's, yeah, and the mics were all medium far away. It's just it's very resonant in there. And, you know, if you kind of play the room right, it sounds wonderful. And,
well, it's a beautiful piece. I'm not sure I hear the Christmas connection, but it's just a sort of the mood, the Baroque.
Right. It's
sense
just festive.
It's just
yeah,
festive.
Right, right. And yeah. So –
just
you know,
imagine the next time you're in your sleigh. And that will be enough to make a Christmas concerto
right.
from
it. We're going to hear more music by Bach, Handel, and others when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Trevor Stevenson, the founder and director of the Madison Bach Musicians, and he's sharing some Baroque Christmas music with us for this Christmas season. We've already heard some Bach. These are short little pieces that we heard before,
right.
Kind of song arrangements, but on the other end of the scale, we have cantata after cantata after cantata, and some
right.
of them specifically for Christmas.
Right, yes. And, you know, some cantatas are half an hour, some are 40 minutes, some are 15 minutes. This is more of the 15-minute variety, but it is a Christmas cantata, and it was performed 1724. Bach's second year at Leipzig when he was launching into this, writing a cantata a week project, you know, and for the unified church year. He's basically addressing every Sunday and festival day in the year, and usually writing fresh material. And not always. Sometimes he would pull something from a little earlier in his life, but he was cranking. He was absolutely cranking. And this one was done the week after Christmas, 1724, and has a New Year's theme to it, kind of integrating Jesus with the New Year. And the metaphor that runs through this is Cantata 122, is that Jesus brings the New Year. The birth of Jesus brings the new year to the soul, kind of thing. It's
And where is Bach getting the text for these?
Oh,
and a cantata is
this one,
really what exactly?
Right, right. This one is based on I think a 17th century hymn, and you'll hear that melody and to the newborn Jesus, and the text is largely from that hymn, I believe, with a few insertions by librettists to be named later, and they're not always sure which librettist did the cantatas. I think this is one of the ones where they're not sure who inserted it. But this is mostly based on the many verses of the original hymn, and often the hymns had 12 verses. 13, 15 verses, and they would take a verse and use it verbatim, or they would gloss it and use it for a movement of the cantata.
Any words that we should know before we listen to it in a language other than English?
Yeah, right. I mean,
17th century German.
Now you should hear right off the out of the gate, Das neu geborene Kindlein. Kindlein is the baby. Right. You'll hear Jesu for Jesus, and Neues Jahr, you're going to hear New Year a lot. And this is just the first movement in which you'll hear it opens with a dance, a completely unrelated Baroque dance, a very elegant kind of a 3/8 light style minuet in the strings, and then out of nowhere the soprano launches into a very slow version of this what would have been a famous melody to the parishioners listening to it at the time, you know. But the effect with this highly detailed eighth note and 16th note minuet going on in the strings, and then long powerful trumpet like notes with the soprano, and then the other singers providing kind of middle ground activity is gears within gears, you know. That's what I call the Baroque clockwork universe, which showing how the little wheels move the medium wheels, move the big wheels, and time in all of its elements. I mean, Bach, I think, is never given enough credit for being an avant-garde filmmaker. But that's exactly what he is, you know. And this is concept art. It's religious concept art.
Wow.
You know, and this particular melody, this that you'll hear in the soprano, runs through all but one movement of this cantata. There are six movements, and it's kind of a Where's Waldo of the, you know, it's like it's always there. Sometimes
looking
it's
for that theme somewhere,
right? And at the end, you get a 30-second straight up version of it with nothing, no funny business around it, just at straight up,
just to prove it's really there,
right? It kind of like the sculptor thing, carving into the rock to find what Michelangelo said,
yes,
that the sculpture's there.
What's not the
right
sculpture.
It's an amazing process, and so we're hearing the beginning here in one of its more complicated forms, and again, how he wrote one of these a week, we'll never know, because they're all different.
How much Christmas music did Bach write? I mean, he wrote small pieces, and he wrote also some very substantial ones.
Right, and the Christmas Oratorio is a collection of, you know, five or six cantatas, which were done, I think, spread out during one Christmas season. Of course, there's Advent cantatas to get it going, you know, it goes really up through New Year's in January 6th at the Epiphany. So I don't know the number, but it would be a lot. It was a huge part of their year. And of course, Easter was was the other, you know. So anyway, I hope it comes through on how interesting that music is, right?
And it's intense.
Very, very intricate. There's a lot of things happening. Great. We open the hour with a familiar Christmas carol, Lo, How the Rose Air Blooming. Can you tell us the story behind that and your performance of it last weekend?
Oh, yes. I think this is Pretorius's arrangement of it. And I think the tune goes way back. And then in the 15-something, Pretorius said, well, here's a nice way to harmonize it. And I think the harmonization we're doing is Pretorius's harmonization. It's like for the Lo, How a Rose Air Blooming. And you'll just hear it in the style we were talking about before, where in four parts, where everyone is really singing as right on the pitch as they can without vibrating, and then you get this beautiful bloom or air blooming, right? And this is a Chelsea Morris soprano, and the alto is a countertenor, Joe Schlesinger. And Peter Gritt, who lives here in Madison, is singing tenor. And Josh Copeland, who lives in England right now, but came to us for this last week, for the concerts that week, singing bass. And there's just two verses of Lo, How a Rose Air Blooming.
No.
Es ist ein Rose entsprungen. That's the original German title, right. Lo, How a Rose Air Blooming, is the standby for English translation.
Right.
And one of the most familiar of
just
all Christmas pieces.
It really brings your blood pressure down.
It does. Well, it's so ethereal. And the way that the harmonies work seem so pure compared to what we're used to hearing on the radio with all kinds of... You know, I think there's something about the simplicity of the just having those voices that
right. I think in one rehearsal I suggested, well, maybe should I join you and play on the harpsichord? the soprano said, I don't think so.
Yeah. Well, one of the pieces of music that always comes up around Christmas is, of course, Handel's Messiah. We're going to sample some pieces from that when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Trevor Stevenson, and we are talking about Baroque Christmas music. I mentioned that Handel's Messiah always comes up at Christmas.
Comes up, yeah.
And I know you featured some excerpts from that on your concert with the Madison Bach musicians.
Yes.
Before we hear a sample, can you tell us something of the story of the Messiah that you think is important to know?
Right. Oh, It actually is kind of fraught with – there are wonderful stories coming from this period. And I've done some reading lately. And of course, Handel's born the same year as Bach in 1685. And then as a young man, he goes to Italy, picks up everything he can, the violin playing and the singing, and somehow marries that to French taste and goes to England and makes a fortune writing this music that has German – construction to it, has good form, it has Italian melodies that you can't forget, right? And it has French bearing, you know, it's a magical combination. When he gets to England, he's not interested in writing operas, but opera taste among the elite is very strong, and so he starts writing operas. He writes, I don't know, 20 of them or something like that. And that goes very well for close to 20 years. And then in the 1730s, opera begins to decline.
And the competition got really rough, too, in English opera circles after a while.
Right. And there was also, I guess, an anti-opera feeling with the Beggar's Opera. And there's a reaction to it. It starts to be made fun of, opera. Anyway, it does fall from favor. And this is Handel's, I think, first or very earliest attempt at an oratorio. There's something that's not an opera. You know,
the difference is that an oratorio, there's not movement around.
Staging, yeah.
Yeah, right. Everybody stays put when they sing these various parts.
Right, right. And so he and Charles Jennens team up and write Messiah. He promises Jennens it'll be his greatest work and may take like a year or something like that. Jennens provides this a very interesting libretto, all pulled from the Bible, but in which Jesus never speaks, which is a fascinating thing, you know. Handel finishes it in 3.5 weeks. And the accounts that Handel said that he actually, you know, saw God before him. The more skeptical people think Handel pulled from old manuscripts and things like that, right? The best things he'd ever written or kept in a secret drawer or whatever. Who knows? But it is certainly a marvelous and I would call it like a cathartic work. Once a year, it's a great cleansing. And of course, it's very theatrical. It has theater built right into it.
You know, was it performed frequently after the big performance in, I think, 1747? Did it become a perennial favorite, or did that take time into the, like, 19th century?
I don't know, and I'm not sure yet what forces. I think the initial Dublin performance was a medium-small group. You're talking about like how often it's done or what size? I don't know.
Because now, of course, we hear it every year. It's inevitable.
Right. And again, it was premiered in Dublin. Yeah, in 1741 or something like that. It's interesting to think of. One writer had said doing it in Dublin was a bit like premiering it in Baltimore, which is,
a little bit off the main circuit.
Right. And then he brings it. It's a success in Dublin, and it also helps get people out of debtor's prison, and it's a benefit for children as well. He takes it back to London. Away from Dublin to London, where he really lives, and it's kind of a much thornier. They love the music, but they can't get over the fact that it's a religious piece being done in a theatrical setting by not very religious musicians.
Well, set up the first sample that we're going to hear.
So anyway, this first one is "But Who May Abide the Day of His Coming," which is a kind of a very 3/8 lilting thing, and that's joined with "For He Is Like a Refiner's Fire," and these are both sung by countertenor Joseph Schlesinger. And then we'll go to one actually from the Easter portion of Messiah, which is "If God Is For Us, Who Can Be Against Us?" So this will be Chelsea Morris, soprano. It's in the key of G minor, and it's the last quiet thing in Messiah before the explosive ending of "Worthy Is the Lamb."
Stand with
one of those highlights of Messiah that you don't hear very often.
Right. It's amazing that you don't hear it very often because it's a great tune, right? And it's just – it's elegant writing. I always think Handel's music really – you know, he writes for singers. It just – it comes right out of the core of the body, you know, and if I were a singer, Handel would be my friend. You know? amazing sensibility. Right. And I always think Mozart inherits Handel's sensibility. It's like he was.
Well, we know that Mozart did an arrangement of Messiah.
That's right, adding clarinets.
Well,
and
kind of rounding off some of the things that I confess. I've only heard it once, and I didn't like it as much as Handel.
Right, right. Handel's instrumentation is very spare, and it works, I think. But
going back to the Baroque Christmas idea of this hour, is there a piece that you can point to as we close that's kind of the quintessential Baroque Christmas piece for you?
Yeah, well, you know, I put this one last here because it's kind of my desert island piece. I don't know what it is about this piece that gets me every time. This is by Heinrich Schütz. It's in the 17th century. It was written during the 30 Years' War as a set of within a set of pieces called Little Spiritual Concerts. Little because there were very few musicians left because of the carnage of the 30 Years' War. And yet, this is the most positive, God-affirming, and God-friendly piece, is what I call it. It's somehow like he's just talking to God, you know. And I think it's one of a kind. With selling it like that, I hope it's good. it's called To God Alone in the Heavens, you know, on High. And it's for vocal quartet. Usually the singers are going to be paired here. You'll hear the soprano start alone and then the alto join. Then they drop out and then the lower parts come in, the tenor and kind of high baritone. And then they all get together. You'll hear the viola da gamba in the background with this beautiful triple rhythm and the Italian harpsichord behind that. So Heinrich Schütz. Thank you.
And that was from the Madison Bach Musicians, taking us back to the 17th century for that part of a Baroque Christmas. Our guest has been Trevor Stevenson.
Thank you. It's been a thrill.
Thanks for joining us again, sharing some of that fine old music. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.